From Yacovet Tapway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Secretary General of Hezbollah says the movement's missiles can hit any target in the occupied territories, adding the demise of Israel is just around the corner. Russia's Gazprom says gas supplies through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Germany will fall to 20% of capacity as Moscow tightens energy squeeze on Europe. And an exit poll shows Tunisian voters have overwhelmingly backed the new constitution, which expands the powers of President Bais Saied. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the Secretary General of Hezbollah's resistance movement warns that there is no point in the occupied territories out of the range of the movement's missiles. Speaking in an interview, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said Hezbollah enjoys sufficient defensive and offensive power at sea. He added that the resistance movement has created powerful deterrence and can strike enemy's targets anywhere in the waters of the occupied Palestine. Nasrallah said Hezbollah's drones have flown over Israel and returned to their bases dozens of times in the past years, and the regime has failed to shoot them down. He also warned Israel against extracting gas from the disputed Karish field before a maritime border agreement is reached with Lebanon. Otherwise, he warned there would be a problem and Hezbollah would do anything to achieve its objectives, even if it means going to war. Hezbollah Secretary General also stressed that Israel has no future and that the end of the regime is very close. Nasrallah said this is not a mere prediction or aspiration, but is based on existing evidence. Joining us from Beirut is Mariam Saleh to give us the latest developments on the situation in Lebanon and the remarks by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah. Mariam, thank you very much for joining us. Hezbollah's message has been clear that it will not allow Israel to extract gas, even ready to use force if necessary. Why does Israel insist on drilling before the maritime boundaries are set? And is the region heading towards a new conflict?
Well, I think that Hezbollah Secretary Nasrallah made it clear, whether in this interview or the interview, the previous speech that he made, that Hezbollah will not allow the Israelis to begin drilling, especially in disputed waters, because he believes that when it comes to the Israelis, Hezbollah has experience with them and how they dealt with South Lebanon, how they dealt with issues while they were occupying Lebanon and throughout all their times of aggressions, how they used to not only plunder and loot Lebanon's natural resources, but also even soil, the clean water, and so on and so forth. So we do not trust that Israel will be actually drilling even in that specific location. They can even go horizontally within the sea and reach areas and trespass and violate Lebanon's waters and continue drilling from that point. Now, he also said that the Israelis are in a hurry to extract natural gas and petrol because this is a result of a U.S. demand, because they believe that they could probably provide Europe with an alternative for gas, an alternative to the Russian gas. And this is part of the huge crisis which the Europeans are living. The Americans, the United States of America, is trying, of course, to provide that alternative because they're trying to, they want to push and continue those sanctions against Russia. So this is one of the reasons why we have that rapid steps being taken by those Israeli companies in order to try to extract. Now, Hezbollah Secretary John said that they will not be allowed. We did see, of course, Hezbollah's words being translated into action when they sent those drones. And another very very important thing that Sayyid Nasrallah mentioned, that he said that Hezbollah wanted the Israelis to take down those drones, that they would not have done their job if the Israeli, the F-16 fighter jets, if their artillery fire did not take down those drones. That way, it is proof that Hezbollah can reach over Quraysh, and he said beyond and beyond Quraysh. So that is a very significant strategic transformation that we have here in the region. Historic conflict between Lebanon and the Israelis, and I believe that it might develop unless we hear something, of course, from the American. We know that he's coming to Lebanon in on the maybe July 30th, July 31st. He is expected to bring a response from the Israelis, of course, going back and forth. But many Lebanese, of course, have questioned the fairness of this U.S. envoy.
Exactly. How reliable of a mediator can Washington be, Mariam? And can it be expected to resolve this standoff without bias against Lebanon?
Well, of course, we do see that from many perspectives here in Lebanon, many believe that the U.S. mediator is not being fair. Of course, they are always siding with Israel. They have previously drawn a line when it comes to demarcating borders, which is much less than what Lebanon had expected. Lebanon has drawn a realistic line that is between the Hof line, the previous U.S. line, and the line 29, which has been put by several Lebanese experts. They believe that line 29 is the official line for Lebanon. As you know, the issue of demarcating maritime waters is very complicated, which is different than the land the land borders, of course, and in, despite the fact that even before colonial power and before the Israeli occupation of Palestine in 1948, there was demarcated lines, and still Lebanon had to fight in order to at least draw a line, which is called now the blue line, the United Nations draw line, in order to at least have some rights, although we believe many Lebanese experts believe that according to United Nations maps, we still have several areas that are continue to be, that are not disputed, that are actually Lebanese, but the United Nations has drawn the line even closer towards Lebanon because of U.S. pressure. So this is, brings us back to the issue, to the fact that the U.S. is putting pressure for the fact to allow the Israelis to drill, but not Lebanon. We have another issue which is very significant. We have companies that have been contracted to come and drill in non-disputed areas that are Lebanese waters, purely Lebanese. And we heard from Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, saying that those countries, like the French Total, for example, they have specifically mentioned that they are under pressure from the United States, from Western countries, not to come and drill even in non-disputed waters, and Lebanon will not be allowed to get their natural resources until the issue is resolved. And one of the issues that Hezbollah is fighting for is that Lebanon should begin drilling as soon as possible, not only the demarcation of the borders, because that would not be very significant for Lebanon if we are not allowed to extract.
Very well. Many thanks to you for joining us, Mariam Saleh from Beirut. 10 more Palestinians become homeless as the Israeli regime demolishes a house in a village south of the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Palestinian sources say Israeli forces also removed a tent belonging to another Palestinian family. There has been a dramatic rise in the demolition of Palestinian homes and infrastructure. In May, Israel's top court ruled in favor of the expulsion of over 1,000 Palestinians from Masafariyata village. Israel had declared much of the territory a restricted military zone in the early 1980s and began forcible expulsion of Palestinians from there. The move triggered a legal battle. Palestinians say Israel's demolition drive in Masafariyata and elsewhere is aimed at making room for more illegal settlements in the occupied territories. Moving on, Russia is tightening its gas squeeze on Europe. Energy giant Gazprom says supplies through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Germany will be slashed to just 20% of its capacity. Gazprom says gas flows to Germany will fall to 33 million cubic meters per day as of Wednesday because it has to halt the operation of a turbine. But Germany, which is Russia's biggest gas customer, says there is no technical reason to limit supplies. In June, Russia cut the pipeline's gas flows to 40% of its capacity before completely shutting it down for 10 days over annual maintenance. The EU has accused Russia of using energy as a weapon, while Moscow blames Western countries and their sanctions over the war in Ukraine for the disruptions. Europe imports about 40% of its gas and 30% of its oil from Russia. A potential halt to gas supplies this winter would plunge Germany into recession, and across the continent, it would lead to soaring prices for consumers already grappling with higher food and energy prices. Russia began its special military operation in neighboring Ukraine in February. However, Moscow's military goals now go beyond the eastern Donbas region, where Russia initially said it wanted to protect the local population. Russia says its new objective is to overthrow the government in Ukraine.
Russia says it might go beyond Donbas, where it once laid the lines of the conflict in Ukraine. The shift was articulated by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who said one reason Russia might expand its operation are the longer-range rockets and artillery the US and NATO allies have been funneling to Ukraine.
The geography is different now. It is not only about the DNR and the LNR, but also about the Kherson region, the Zaporizhia region, and a number of other territories, and this process is continuing consistently and persistently.
Lavrov's remarks are the clearest comments that Russia's objectives have expanded over the 5 months of war. Earlier, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Lavrov's statement confirmed what Washington and its allies had suspected were Russian President Vladimir Putin's objectives all along.
He has stated a number of times that, you know, this is a limited operation focused on the Donbass. His actions have proven otherwise.
The U.S., despite claiming that it knew about Russia's intentions, only seems to be further fueling the war through its support for Kiev. The U.S.'s military assistance has topped $8 billion U.S. dollars, part of a $40 billion aid package. And all this while analysts view diplomacy as the only tangible solution to the ongoing conflict.
The U.S. empire's strategic aim is to expand NATO eastwards, right up to the borders of the Russian Federation, stage coups where necessary, as in Ukraine in 2014. And in the words of Canada's Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, to vanquish Russia, divide it up and gobble up its component parts, the better to march on to China. It's a hegemonic agenda, and there is no way that the U.S. will tolerate the Ukrainian government having a negotiated peace with Russia. Rather, the plan is that to drag the Russian Federation into a long war.
Washington claims to be supporting Ukraine to defend itself. Officials in Kiev have, however, suggested that Crimea, which the West still recognizes as part of Ukraine, could be a target for U.S.-made missiles recently deployed by Kiev. The remark, however, prompted a fierce response from the former Russian president, warning that an attack on Crimea will ignite a Judgment Day response.
Shortly after Russia began its campaign in Ukraine, Western countries rolled out economic sanctions against Moscow. But now European leaders seem to be rethinking their decisions as those policies backfire on their economies.
The West, led by the U.S., apart from supplying financial aid, has also imposed a wide range of unprecedented sanctions against Moscow in support for Kiev. The bans have targeted individuals, banks, businesses, and state-owned enterprises, including the oil and gas sector.
The U.S. also planned an economic war on Russia by leveling economic sanctions, which are unilateral and illegal, by excluding Russia from the SWIFT transfer system, by stealing its monetary resources stored in Western banks, and by cutting it off from its natural trading partners in Europe.
The economic impact of the war and the sanctions on Russia is showing across the world. Inflation is up in many countries, global supply chains have been disrupted, and there are fears of food shortages. But now, experts fear the situation, especially in Europe, could further deteriorate as the continent struggles to find middle grounds on solutions to the current uncertainties.
But the U.S. sanctions backfired on the West, especially on Europe, where Europe took the brunt of the energy cutbacks. And it caused, the U.S. war caused an inflationary crisis for the entire world.
All this has also led to indications of fatigue settling in the EU. The Hungarian Prime Minister has so far been the most vocal about his concerns regarding the bloc's strategies on Ukraine.
West's strategy on Ukraine has failed as governments in Europe are collapsing like dominoes. Energy prices have surged. A new strategy is needed, which should focus on peace talks and drafting a good peace proposal instead of winning the war.
But despite the heavy costs incurred by Europeans, the bloc's leaders seem to have set their eyes on continuing their way. While standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. The International Energy Agency has even warned that a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch this winter awaits Europe, mainly due to the possibility of Russia cutting off gas supplies completely.
In other news, Tunisian voters have overwhelmingly voted in favor of a new constitution which expands the powers of President Kais Saied. An exit poll shows over 92% of voters have supported the new constitution. According to Tunisia's Electoral Commission, at least 27.5% of 9.3 million registered voters cast their ballots. The initial results of the referendum are expected on Tuesday afternoon. The turnout is seen as a gauge of Saeed's popularity after a year of tight one-man rule. Saeed is accused by his rivals of trying to install an autocracy in the North African country. Observers say many of the voters were from middle classes fed up with high inflation and unemployment. The new constitution places the president in command of the army, allows him to appoint a government without parliamentary approval, and makes him virtually impossible to remove from office. And those were the top stories for this hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
With medicines in short supply, power outages, and spare parts for electric scooters and wheelchairs increasingly unaffordable, disabled people in Gaza are enduring unimaginable suffering, says Ahmad Al-Samak, journalist, in an article published under the heading Siege of Gaza, taking terrible toll on people with disabilities. Stay tuned for more. Nidal Helis, 33, was waiting for his father to take him to the toilet. When Ashraf, 55, arrived from the mosque after praying, he lowered Nidal into his wheelchair and pushed him to the bathroom. Since birth, Nidal has had paralysis in his left leg, where bed sores have spread recently. His condition gradually worsened after he broke his patella 10 years ago following a fall from his wheelchair. Nidal said, while lying on a worn-out green sofa, "Bed sores have spread in my leg. They cause unbearable pain. Gazan doctors will have nothing to do with me. I can't bear my pain. All my neighbors hear me screaming in pain every single day." So that Nidal had undergo knee replacement surgery at Al-Maqasid Hospital in Al-Quds, he and his father have applied to the Palestinian General Authority of Civil Affairs 5 times since August 2021. However, medical procedures have been delayed 4 times by the Israeli regime, as it does with almost half of Gazan patients, who experience delays and bans from access to the West Bank, Al-Quds, under security pretexts, although the Palestinian Authority covers all costs. The measures are part of the Zionist regime's suffocating siege on the Gaza Strip, which is now in its 15th year. The land, sea, and air blockade was imposed after Hamas won legislative elections in 2006. The Zionist regime has devastated social and economic life in the coastal enclave, and severe restrictions on the movement of people and goods have left 2 million Palestinians living in an open-air prison. According to a monthly report by the World Health Organization in April, the Zionist regime approved only 57% of entry permits by patients from Gaza. International human rights groups and UN mechanisms have characterized the siege as unlawful collective punishment. "We get a message a day before the appointment from the Authority of Civil Affairs that says our application is under consideration. Our security check, although I worked in the territories for more than a decade," said Ashraf, a father of 7, 6 of them unemployed, adding, "The alternative is to go to Egypt, but I can't afford the expenses, as I need at least $2,000. The worst thing is the 12-hour journey to Cairo and the 3-day return journey to Gaza due to Egyptian military operations in the Sinai Desert. How will my son bear that?" The father, whose main source of income is welfare payments from the Ministry of Social Affairs, needs up to $100 for Nidal's treatments every month. Feda Al-Rafi, 33, has hemiplegia, a condition caused by brain damage that leads to paralysis on one side of the body, and acidosis, a skin disorder. She needs an air conditioner and an air mattress, but due to the daily electricity outages in Gaza Strip, which last from 8 to 16 hours, and her family's financial situation, she cannot have them. "We can't afford a conditioner, so I have a fan, but we don't have another electricity source. When it cuts out, I sweat and have to scratch my skin, then my skin bleeds," Rafi said, adding, During the outages, I sleep on the ground without a mattress. Despite being painful for my back, sleeping in such a way is better than bleeding due to the heat. The electricity crisis badly affects people with disabilities in Gaza, as it means there is no power for lifts or for charging of electric wheelchair batteries and air mattresses, among other things. My mobility scooter battery needs 4 hours to be fully charged. The problem is that I go to sleep early. The electricity returns at 10 p.m. on the 3 or 4 days a week, and it cuts off at 6 a.m. before I wake up, Rafi said, adding, because I can't charge my scooter and therefore leave my home, I often have to cancel my appointments. The poverty rate in Gaza is 53%, and the medicine Rafi needs, which costs up to $200 a month, is too expensive for her father, Muhammad, 56, to afford. All her body is supposed to be covered with creams 3 times daily, especially when the electricity outages cause her to start sweating, said Muhammad, an electrical technician and a father of 10, adding, sometimes we can't find her medicine in Gaza, so we have to buy the alternatives, which are not effective. But she doesn't suffer from the lack of medicine as much as she does from the electricity outages. Human Rights Watch issued a report in 2020 that said a decade of Israeli regime restrictions have robbed people with disabilities in Gaza of their freedom of movement, as well as access to the devices, electricity, and technology they need to communicate or leave their homes. Muhammad Amrin, 33, a father of 3, has cerebral palsy and completely depends on his mobility scooter. Due to the Gaza siege, the price of spare parts for scooters and electric wheelchairs has soared. My scooter has been out of order for more than a year, and I can't afford the 1,500 shekels it would cost to repair it, so I have to walk on my crutches for 50 minutes every day to find a cheap ride, said Amrin, who has a diploma in accounting he has never been able to use. I have a stand at a secret market and work from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. for around 25 shekels a day. The taxi fares cost me 8 shekels daily. If the price of spare parts ever become affordable again, I would repair my wheelchair and save the 8 shekels for my family, he said. Some local civil society groups grant people with disabilities a new electric wheelchair every 2 or 3 years, depending on funds. The NGOs include the National Society for Rehabilitation, Baslam for Social Rehabilitation, Society of Physically Handicapped People, and others. Most of them are run by Gazans, but funded by regional and international organizations and countries. Amrin said, I received mine, which is out of order, in 2018. When I asked if I could get a new one, the society told me there was no funds. Of the 2.17 million Palestinians in Gaza have disabilities, according to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics. The quality of spare parts for electric wheelchairs and mobility scooters is poor. They are not always available, and their prices are high, said Ali Al-Hendi, the owner of a workshop for electric wheelchairs. The motherboard price is 1,500 shekels compared to 600 shekels in 2012. The average price of a charger is 800 shekels, up from $100 in 2012. I tried to import secondhand electric wheelchairs and mobility scooters last year, which banned me from doing so. The prices have tripled and quadrupled because of the siege, Hendi said, adding, 10 years ago, I used to carry out 2 or 3 projects a month for local societies to maintain electric wheelchairs and scooters. Now, I do 1 every 2 or 3 months. Due to the deteriorating situation, donors tend to fund relief rather than developmental projects, said Jamal A. Rosie, director of the National Society for Rehabilitation. A relief project provides humanitarian aid to the needy people during and after a crisis. In contrast, development projects aim to generate a source of income for people with disabilities in the long term through various small economic projects, he said. Besides the lack of spare parts and the catastrophic effects of the electricity outages on people with disabilities, foreign funds have been dramatically increased. The fund my society has received recently is 60% less than before the siege. Unfortunately, we were forced last year to terminate a long-term project for 2,000 Gazans with disabilities due to the lack of funds. According to the 4th Geneva Convention, denying disabled people access to hospitals in the West Bank and banning medical equipment could constitute to war crimes, said Salah Abdul Ati, a human rights expert and director of the International Commission to Support Palestinian People's Rights. He said, "There must be an intervention by the international community to break the siege of Gaza and to allow the entry of all medical equipment and devices to people with disabilities." Nidal has a new appointment on August 8 at Al-Maqasid Hospital, he said. "I appeal to all people to help me receive my treatment. Doctors warn me that if I don't have my leg treated, I will get gangrene and might have to have my leg amputated. Please, I don't want this."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Welcome to another episode of Palestine Declassified, where we examine the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm Chris Williamson, and I'm the host for today's show. In this week's programme, we're looking at an obscure British-based organisation that's active in conflict zones from Palestine to Ireland and beyond. We'll be delving into its background and ask, what is it really up to? As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, Bianca Rahimi has this report about a seemingly innocent group known as Forward Thinking, which claims to sponsor dialogue on issues of conflict.
is Israel outsourcing its normalization drive among Muslims to a well-known conflict resolution front for British intelligence? Forward Thinking is an organization which explicitly seeks to normalize Israel within the Middle East and among the Muslim community elsewhere. Here, the founder of Forward Thinking and veteran NATO employee Oliver McTernan explains the origins of the organization being a NATO conference where the following happens.
In that group, there were a number of Arab scholars from the Middle East and a handful of Israelis, including the commandant of the IDF law school, Amos Giora. And it was at the end of the 3-4 days, Amos said to us, you can't leave this just as a conference. We've got to see how it can be taken forward. And it was that that sparked the idea of Forward Thinking, and an invitation came then from him to come to Israel-Palestine to meet key people and to see what could be done.
Of course, Amos Giora was the highest legal opinion in the Israeli military and was tasked with constructing legal arguments to justify the bombing of civilian sites like schools in Gaza. The roots of Forward Thinking can also be found in another long-time NATO employee and reserve in the British Army Intelligence Corps, Chris Donnelly's trip to the Hutsliya Security Conference in the apartheid entity. The future director of Forward Thinking attended this key Israeli military and intelligence conference in 2007 alongside a colleague of his and McTernan, Daniel Lafayedni. Both Donnelly and McTernan also shared positions on the Institute for Statecraft with Lafayedni. However, at the Hutsliya conference, Lafayedni stated his organizational home as BICOM, Britain's largest Israel lobby group. Forward Thinking's own trustees report states that it worked closely with Likud during the Netanyahu government to bring the previously pro-Palestinian Sinn Féin to the table of normalization with Israel. It was a long process of subverting Sinn Féin and defanging their pro-Palestinian stance. This engagement with the Israeli regime is something Forward Thinking openly take credit for bringing about. Oliver McTernan can be seen here at the Israeli government-funded Menachem Begin Heritage Center celebrating the normalization of relations between Egypt and Israel, alongside senior figures across the Israeli political spectrum. Menachem Begin was the head of the Zionist terror organization Irgun, which bombed the King David Hotel, killing 91 people, many of them British administrators. Forward Thinking proudly describes the terrorist Begin as having a legacy of making peace. Other posts on the Forward Thinking website describe influential Israelis helping develop our programs and show Oliver McTernan in the Knesset securing feedback on recent activities. Muslim organizations, political figures, and leaders must be under no illusion. Forward Thinking and Oliver McTernan work for Israel.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David co-founded and is a co-director of Spinwatch, the lobbying watchdog. We're also joined by Mohammed Almazi. Mohammed is a freelance journalist and he studied law at SOAS in London. He's contributed to numerous media outlets, including Jacobin, The Canary, Open Democracy, and The Grey Zone. He's also written extensively about the attempt to extradite Julian Assange to the US and has covered all of the extradition hearings. Welcome to the show. Now, David, let me get this straight. Is Forward Thinking working for British and Israeli intelligence simultaneously?
Well, it's been set up by people who have military intelligence, British military intelligence connections, and it was set up at the behest of someone from the IDF. So it appears to be taking forward interests which are shared between British military intelligence and the Israeli state. But that's not entirely unusual. I mean, there are many organizations in this country which are engaged in counter-terrorism type activity, counter-extremism type activity, funded by the British government, but which are actually Zionist organizations. So it's not unusual for that to be the case, but it is unusual to find British military intelligence directly running an organization which appears to have this direct connection to Israel. That's slightly unusual, but the overall ideological confluence is not unusual.
And Mohammed, what can you tell us about this Chris Donnelly character?
Chris Donnelly, a member of SGMI, that specialist group military intelligence, a former advisor to NATO who focused on the Soviet Union. He, at least at the time, or SGMI is based in Hermitage Barracks in Denison. Or sorry, Denison Barracks in Hermitage. Is that, yeah, forgive me. Right next to where the 77th Brigade is based. And the 77th Brigade are a military PSYOP unit. I mean, people can go and read about it in articles in, I think, the BBC, Wired magazine.
It's a British military.
It's a British military propaganda and PSYOP unit,
yeah.
Which itself is an amalgamation of previous units that
sure.
then came together.
Yeah.
And Donnelly is also a founder of numerous organizations, which we have since discovered are funded in part or in whole by the Home Office, the Foreign Office, NATO, and other institutions like the Smith Richardson Foundation, which is a neoconservative market fundamentalist institute.
Mm-hmm.
And these groups include, or the organizations that he's co-founded include, the Institute for Statecraft and one of their projects, the Integrity Initiative, ironically
yeah.
named Integrity Initiative, which well, is also a PSYOP group.
We'll touch on those. Organisations in a little bit more detail later. But David, Oliver McTernan and Forward Thinking, they seem to have quite a wide access, don't they, to pro-resistance factions. I mean, what do you think about this kind of interaction? I mean, is it valid? I mean,
well, so it comes out of this sort of idea that that peace processes are things which bring together formerly warring partners and resolve conflict and move on to a nice, peaceful future. And they look back to the South African process or the process in the north of Ireland, and they say their argument is, well, we have to have dialogue to bring the warring partners together to resolve the conflict in order for there to be peace.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, what is really happening with an organization like this is that they are penetrating resistance factions, like including Hamas. They're engaged with Hamas and with other Palestinian resistance factions and in other conflicts too, and they're bringing them towards some kind of negotiation with their sworn enemies, and in fact, towards a normalization process, mm. to normalize the existence of the State of Israel and of Zionism as an occupation force in Palestine. So it's a means to defang and to remove the sting from the resistance. And it's not presented as that, of course,
yeah.
and sometimes the resistance factions who engage in this discussion and dialogue aren't aware that that's mm. the case. Sometimes they will be aware and they'll have their own reasons for doing it, but it certainly isn't some kind of neutral, let's all link pinks and be friends together dialogue process. It's about undermining the resistance and bringing them to effectively defeat.
Hmm. And a bit closer to home, I mean, just tell us a little bit about Forward Thinking's normalisation process in Ireland.
So they've done a similar thing in Ireland. Now, of course, the people will have different views, I guess, on the peace process in Ireland, but, you know, Sinn Féin has, over the decades, been a very steadfast ally of the Palestinians. You know, I go to Ireland regularly, and you can still see flying over the Bogside in Derry the Palestinian flag. And if you go to the Unionist villages round and about Derry, they have the Israeli yeah, flag flying along with various loyalist paramilitary and terrorist group flags. So there's a very strong connection between the Irish Republican movement and the Palestinian Liberation Movement. They see themselves as being brothers in arms.
Mm.
And the forward-thinking involvement has tried to draw Sinn Féin into a dialogue with Likud, and to try and bring them to some kind of dialogue with Likud, which is effectively a breach of the boycott and a normalisation mm. process. Now, there's been a big controversy about this in Sinn Féin, mm. and indeed in Irish Palestine solidarity organisations where there's been a fight over it, and the people in Sinn Féin have been divided over it. But it does look like some factions of Sinn Féin
wow.
have gone along with this, and it's a very sad day for Irish Palestine solidarity work for that mm. to be the case.
Quite surprising, that to say the least. But Mohammed, does it surprise you that there is this kind of crossover between British and Israeli intelligence in this way? I mean, what's your thoughts about that?
Not necessarily. I mean, as if one looks at the history of relations in this region, normalization, that is to say, the push by Britain and the United States in particular, but not only, to get other states and groups and individuals to normalize relations with Israel without preconditions, so without Israel having to dismantle its illegal colonies, settlements, or bring an end to the apartheid system, has been a very long-term project. In fact, there are massive shifts in it. Recently, since Trump came to power, we've seen the the post-revolution government in Sudan opening up normalization of relations openly. We've also heard reports, and there have been some public reporting as well, about Saudi Arabia and other countries which currently don't recognize the state of Israel, primarily because of how it was founded and what it continues to do. So there isn't anything particularly new in the push. This is just perhaps the latest stage, because there are long periods of time where the push was going nowhere. We saw the same thing with apartheid South Africa, where pushes to normalize, for all countries to have normalized relations with apartheid South Africa, notwithstanding its existence as an apartheid state or its racialized discrimination against the indigenous population, the way the state of Israel does the same towards the Palestinians, the indigenous population of Palestine and of the state of Israel.
Indeed. And there's certain very clear parallels, isn't there, between, apartheid South Africa and, the discrimination that the Israeli regime is engaged in Palestine. But, David, I mean, some might say, look, there's nothing wrong with, and on the face of it, there doesn't appear to be anything wrong with conflict resolution in Palestine, obviously. What do you say to people saying that you're slightly overdoing it?
Well, it's not conflict. That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, there is an occupation, and the occupation has to end, and that will remove the conflict. We don't remove the conflict by defeating the Palestinians. We remove the conflict by removing the occupation. And there's no other way of seeing it. You don't have peace without justice, and the only way to justice is to decolonize the whole of occupied Palestine. So, this idea that there are two sides or two tribes fighting over land or two ethnic groups or competing nationalisms, this is all rubbish. This is about Israeli colonialism, settled colonialism, which settled the land of Palestine and expelled the natives. Everybody knows this, but they try and deny it sometimes. Everybody knows that this is a settler colony, just as a settler colony existed in South Africa, and indeed in the north of Ireland. And the root of the conflict in Northern Ireland, just the same as the root of the conflict in Palestine, it's settler colonialism, and you only end it by removing the settlers.
I mean, when you say, of course, everybody knows this, I mean, the truth is that, when you actually make that argument, very often, as you well know, and I've been a victim of this as well, have been subjected to accusations of anti-Semitism, haven't we? But anyway, we'll have to leave it there for a moment, because I just want to look at this report now on the Institute for Statecraft, a shadowy think tank that's connected to Forward Thinking.
Forward Thinking is clearly a British intelligence operation in the service of Israeli normalization objectives. Another organization which features several of the same figures is also suspected to be a push by British intelligence in a war of the minds. The Institute for Statecraft describes itself as a pro-democracy think tank. However, closer examination reveals it to be an insinuation of British intelligence dabbling in all manner of psychological warfare against both local and global targets. It's funded by the UK Ministry of Defence, NATO, the US State Department, and Facebook. The Institute for Statecraft has shared directors with handmaidens of the Israeli regime, Forward Thinking. Oliver McTiernan is simultaneously a director of the Institute for Statecraft and Forward Thinking. Chris Donnelly was also previously a director of both organizations at the same time. Daniel Lefeedni of Israel lobby group BICOM was also a key figure of the board of the Institute for Statecraft. Our host at Palestine Declassified, Chris Williamson, previously doorstepped the intelligence operation, coming face to face with Daniel Lefeedni. Whilst our shadowy protagonists seem allergic to sunlight, Forward Thinking and the Institute for Statecraft are clearly branches of the same tree. These shadowy figures of perception manipulation must be exposed.
David, I understand that Forward Thinking's been active in Tunisia, haven't they? I mean, what relevance do you think that has to the normalisation push in Tunisia?
Well, it's part of that process, isn't it? I mean, it appears from the work that they've done there and indeed other places that they're sort of involved in regime change and post-regime change activities. So they're trying to normalise in Tunisia, which would involve normalisation with the Zionist entity. And in a leaked report, a confidential report from Forward Thinking, which was leaked through the Integrity Initiative leak from the Institute for Statecraft in 2018, there's a report there which compares the normalisation process in Tunisia and the work they've been doing in Tunisia with the process which happened in Ukraine after the US-backed coup in 2014. So there's a real sense there that they're following the same kind of process which the West, in particular the US, but also the UK, were involved in Ukraine to try and change the Ukraine away from having any kind of relationship with Russia, which of course has led to the current conflict that there is in Ukraine. So this is a part of a sort of US State Department military intelligence, MI6 operation to move countries like Tunisia away from criticism of Israel, and in the case of Ukraine, to move Ukraine closer to the NATO orbit, which of course has had the disastrous consequences that we've seen in the last few months with the conflict in Ukraine.
Yes, indeed. I mean, we've just seen, haven't we, Mohammed, in that piece there about the Institute for Statecraft, which is clearly a sister organisation to Forward Thinking. Tell us a little bit about your investigations into the Institute, and particularly in relation to the Integrity Initiative.
Okay, so in 2018, a group calling itself Anonymous Europe hacked and published in stages documents belonging to the Institute of Statecraft and the Integrity Initiative, which is a project of the Institute for Statecraft. They include emails, but also reports. And basically, a review of the document showed, among other things, that this this group and this organization, which is co-founded by Chris Donnelly and Dan Lafayedny. Mm-hmm. Dan Lafayedny is a former SAS, a former member of British Special Forces, and they're also involved in other organizations, as we've heard, but including the Active Change Foundation, which targets children to in deprived communities, especially minority groups. Instilling a military ethos in British society is something they very much believe in. They've written articles and reports saying as much. And the Integrity Initiative is on a rather sophisticated version, evidence of a sophisticated version of what Russia was accused of doing in the United States but never proven of doing during the elections, two presidential elections ago when Trump was won. So they have these clusters in various countries, that's what they call them, a network of networks, and each cluster has academics, politicians, military, ex or current members of the national security state apparatus in those respective countries. And the idea is that they internally work to push a concerted sort of objective, a certain perspective, but publicly, everyday members of the public are not meant to know that they're working together. Right, so there's nothing wrong with having an objective and trying to convince people of it, but this is a state-funded, Foreign Office-funded, NATO-funded outfit with journalists and others who are working together to push certain narratives or propagandize, basically, their respective societies. The tagline for the Integrity Initiative is defending democracy against disinformation. Mm. And while targeting Russian real or alleged disinformation seems to be part of it, another big part of it is about reshaping how people in the British and other public perceive the state of the world. I mean, that's evidenced by a report, internal report from Chris Donnelly, who argued that once upon a time, only one-third of British state funds were dedicated towards housing and health and social services. And they would like to convince, overtly or covertly, the British public to go back to that, because they complain now that two-thirds of spending are on health and social security and welfare issues, and not enough is spent on the military. Mm. And they want to invert that. They want to go back to what they consider to be a wartime mentality.
Well, they seem to be having some influence over the current British government in terms of where their priorities are currently lie. But David, thinking about this crossover between British and Israeli intelligence, I mean, some people have suggested that my role in uncovering the shady activities of the Institute for Statecraft contributed to me being pushed out of Parliament. I mean, what do you think to that theory?
Well, you've always got to be very cautious in these areas, haven't you? When we're talking about the covert activities of intelligence agencies, which are by their nature secretive. And the information that we have about them comes in bits and pieces. We had the Integrity Initiative leaks. We've had more recently the Paul Mason leaks, where the former BBC journalist Paul Mason was in direct contact with this MI6 official who has been involved in a whole range of different covert propaganda operations and activities, including the Integrity Initiative back in 2018. So we don't have a full picture, but it's very clear that they have been targeting people like you and indeed me from the emails and the discussions. They deliberately go after people like us. And of course, I was sacked partly as a result of a campaign by the Zionists, but it's also clear from the most recent Mason documents that there was a deliberate campaign to target me specifically and others who've been working with me. No doubt there's been similar campaigns against you, and you can spot sometimes the signs of that, but we don't have emails leaked as yet to show the full extent of any kind of campaign that might have been against you. But let's be clear about this. The Integrity Initiative was a project funded by the Foreign Office, directed by MI6, and run by military intelligence. They actually put an MI6, serving MI6 officer, inside the organization to oversee it, I always imagine, because MI6 couldn't trust military intelligence to get anything right, and you know, quite right. But what happened to it was that there were complaints made. The organization was registered in Scotland to a derelict mill, and you went
and had
a look to at the mill.
Yeah.
And of course, a complaint was put into the Scottish Charity Regulator, which is separate from the English Charity Commission, and is way less penetrated by neoconservative interests. And the Scottish Charity Regulator concluded that if you're working for MI6 or the Foreign Office, you can't call yourself a charity.
So they effectively
shut the whole project down. Yeah. And that was a really very clear victory for the campaigners doing that, including us. So no doubt that didn't go down very well with MI6.
Right, okay, yeah. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now, as unfortunately we are completely out of time. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.